Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the August 15th and August 22nd editions of People Magazine, as well as Oprah Daily, the online email newsletter. Some of the articles I'll share today include Helen Mirren, Funny, Fabulous, and Unfiltered, Secrets of the Golden Girls, and Five Secrets to Aging Well. Helen Mirren, Funny, Fabulous, Unfiltered. More in demand than ever at 80, the actress is having a ball larking about on multiple projects, including her new mystery romp, The Thursday Murder Club, Just Don't Dare Call Her Feisty, by Eric Anderson, photographs by Martin DeBoer. This is a People exclusive. Over the course of her storied career, Helen Mirren has racked up an eclectic mix of honors. She's a dame, a title bestowed by Queen Elizabeth II in 2003. She's an Academy Award winner, thanks to her portrayal of the aforementioned monarch in 2006's The Queen. She's also a cocktail on offer at Powell's Lounge, a New Orleans bar once owned by her late stepson. "The Helen Effin Mirren," says the actress with a hearty laugh, repeating the NSFW moniker. Made with Darjeeling liquor, Earl Grey tea, vodka, habanero, and honey, the drink is an homage to the beloved Brit's spicy side, which is on full display during an hour-long interview with People. She drops a few swear words, claims that her Oscar and SAG trophies, both beautiful young men, are having an affair, and brags about her Formula One level skills behind the wheel. "I'm rather foolishly vain about my driving," she says. "I'm sure I could have been a racing car driver." At 80, Mirren, who has been married to Oscar-nominated Ray director Taylor Hackford, 80, for almost 28 years, is keeping her foot on the gas pedal in more ways than one. Over a six-month span in 2024 and 2025, she filmed a slew of projects, from the Western series 1923 and the crime drama Mobland, to the new Netflix movie, The Thursday Murder Club. "It was intense, but you just get into the rhythm of it," says Mirren, who also appears in a cheeky Uber Eats commercial, which features her wondering about seeing her neighbor naked. "Sometimes you have what I call a bit of a car crash of projects, and they all want to go at the same time." One of those projects, Murder Club, resonated so much, she considers it her favorite ever. That's a bold statement considering her six-decade career that includes award-winning series, Prime Suspect, acclaimed films, Gosford Park, and massive hit movies. She narrated Barbie. In Murder Club, the highly anticipated adaptation of Richard Osman's cozy mystery novel, a book that Mirren devoured after it came out in 2020. She's joined by Ben Kingsley, Celia Imrie, and Pierce Brosnan, the last of whom calls Mirren captivating in every sense of the word. On set, there was a sense of, Gosh, guys, isn't this amazing? Here we all are again, says Mirren, who had shared the stage or screen with all three co-stars before. Kingsley was Mirren's peer at the Royal Shakespeare Company in the 1960s and 70s. Imrie co-starred in 2003's Calendar Girls, and Mirren and Brosnan, who also plays her husband on Mobland, both appeared in 1980's The Long Good Friday, though they didn't have any scenes together. Reunited after long, varied careers, the stars play retirement home residents and amateur cold case crime solvers in Murder Club. When the co-owner of their complex is killed, the quartet put their skills to use to find the culprit. But some of the younger folks underestimate them. On that point, Mirren has some thoughts. People who are retired have had extraordinarily productive, challenging, difficult professional lives, and they're not finished. It doesn't suddenly screech to a halt, says Mirren. Younger people cannot comprehend the fact that the older generation had sex, had fun, danced, were obsessed with their hair and their weight. And of course, the older people are looking at them and going, you know what? We've done that. We've been there. While Mirren may not often feel underestimated, she does bristle when people talk down to her. One thing that I find galling as I get older is the sort of patronizing condescension. Oh, that is so sweet, she continues, affecting a, well, patronizing tone. I hate the word feisty. I'm alive. Don't give me those sort of awful labels. Like having a young spirit. Asked if she recalls her reply to another interviewer who referred to her as such. Mirren responds with hilarious candor. What did I say? She asks. F off? For the record, she replied, my spirit is the age that I am. Mirren is not one to dwell on her age or her milestone birthday, which just passed on July 26th. Honestly, I don't celebrate birthdays. I don't recognize them because life just rolls on, she says. I expect to be very, very nicely treated on my birthday. That's all I want. Cup of tea in bed in the morning. Her husband obliges. Giving each other freedom, she says, is one of the keys to their long and happy marriage. The pair met when Hackford cast her in his 1985 movie White Nights, and they wed 12 years later. I love having him by my side when he is by my side, and I love being on my own when I'm on my own, and he allows that, and likewise, I allow him. She explains. But allowance only goes so far. If I wasn't by his side and someone else was, I'd be rather pissed off about that, she jokes. The couple have worked together a handful of times in the past, including on the 2010 drama Love Ranch, co-starring Joe Pesci, but those days are behind them. I don't really like collaborating with Taylor, quite honestly. I love watching him work. I love being with him as he's planning, as he's developing, as he's filming, Mirren says. But I want my work to be separate from him. The pair faced tragedy 3 years ago when Hackford's son, actor and former Powell's Lounge owner, Rio Hackford, died from uveal melanoma at age 51. In the years since, Mirren, who is also stepmom to Hackford's younger son, music supervisor Alex Hackford, 46, has made it her mission to urge people to get screened for the rare eye cancer by getting regular optometrist checkups. If he'd had his eyes checked, they would have caught it early, says Mirren, who keeps Rio's picture as her phone screensaver. I look at his face all the time. Even on a rare day off, Mirren, one of three children raised in a working-class Southern England family by Kathleen, a stay-at-home mother, and Basil, a Russian immigrant who worked as a taxi driver and civil servant, is not the type to lounge around. If I'm still in bed after 8 o'clock, I start feeling guilty, she says. There's always stuff to do. More often than not, she'll partake in some yoga. Not a lot, like 20 minutes, 30 at the max. I hate sweating, but you do realize it's good to exercise every day, she says. Perhaps Mirren, who has homes in both the U.S. and Europe, will do some gardening, feed the birds, or go for a drive while listening to an audiobook. In the car, I'm not a big music person, she says. But how does she decide when to work and when to relax at this point in her career? I don't choose. It's chosen for me by scheduling, she says. There's no choice in the business at all. That's not entirely true. Mirren opts to work at a brisk pace. But even after decades in the business, she still faces fear when starting something new. I get absolutely terrified, says Mirren, because every project that you go into is an unknown. You never know how it's going to be or how the people are going to be and whether the chemistry will be good or a disaster. So stepping into a project is nerve-wracking, not least because every single one is completely different and has a different energy and a different requirement. You never know if you're going to sort of step up or not. And so, even the queen will pretend to have some of the swagger she's known for until she actually feels it. Fake it till you make it. Very wise words, very important words, very fundamentally human words, she says. Walking into a party, or walking into a job interview, or whatever it is you're having to deal with, we all have to sort of gird our loins. Wise words from Helen Effin Mirren. Hot for Helen. These men love Mirren. She's one of those magnetic personalities. Everybody who meets with her flirts with her. Ryan Reynolds. Gorgeous, iconic, Dave Franco. She's sexy. She'll look at you and you go, oh, S, 50 Cent. I just love her. I do. I've had a massive crush on her for years. James Marsden. How she left made her mark. Excalibur. Making the 1981 fantasy was major fun, says Mirren, who dated co-star Liam Neeson for 5 years. The Cook, the Thief, his wife, and her lover. I laughed nonstop, Mirren says, of making the sexy dark comedy. Prime Suspect. The police procedural taught me so much about working in front of a camera, says Mirren with Richard Hawley. Gosford Park. Mirren, with Clive Owen, earned a Best Supporting Actress Oscar nomination for her role in the 2001 mystery. The Queen. It was a journey. I loved being that person, she says, of playing Queen Elizabeth II in the 2006 film. You have been listening to a People Magazine exclusive. Helen Mirren, Funny, Fabulous, Unfiltered. A 40th Anniversary Celebration, Secrets of the Golden Girls. In 1985, a sitcom debuted that would change TV and the lives of its four over 50 stars. 4 decades after it ended, the show's legacy lives on in the laughter of every new generation that discovers its magic. By Jeremy Heligar from People Magazine. Television had never seen anything like it. 4 female friends living in a major city, frequently sitting around a table discussing their lives and loves over food, with a healthy dose of sex talk thrown into the mix. No, we're not talking about Sex and the City. More than a decade before Carrie Bradshaw and her besties first graced our screens, The Golden Girls, which premiered on NBC September 14, 1985, was the first beloved TV series to focus on 4 female friends. But here's the twist. Our heroines were all played by actresses over 50. Bea Arthur was top billed as divorcee Dorothy Zbornak, who shared a house in Miami with widows Blanche Devereaux, Rue McClanahan, and Rose Nyland, Betty White, as well as her 80-something mother, Sophia Petrillo, Estelle Getty. There was no question that we had something wonderful. Tony Thomas, 76, who executive produced all 7 seasons with Paul Junger Witt, recalls of the first table read with the actresses. It was like watching an all-star game, and it just got better every day. The Golden Girls was an immediate hit. There was a universality in the show, the series creator Susan Harris, 84, says. It didn't depend on people being young or pretty, and people really identified with that. Thomas adds of the unprecedented focus on older characters. This is life after your first life. You don't have to slow down. You can create a new family. Life does not end. That's the promise of the show. More than 30 years after its final episode in 1992, and nearly 4 years after the death of the last surviving Golden Girl, White, who died in 2021 at age 99, the reruns continue to attract young fans whose parents weren't even alive when the show began. It's amazing how it appeals to women, young kids. My grandkids loved the Golden Girls from when they were little, Harris says. It presented real women in a real way. In celebration of the Golden Girls' 40th anniversary this year, here are some surprising revelations from behind the scenes. The Golden Girls was supposed to be about just 2 older women, and the idea was sparked by Miami Vice. Night Court star Selma Diamond and Remington Steele actress Doris Roberts were introducing a new show called Miami Vice at the 1984 NBC Upfronts when they started arguing about the popular cop show's title. The banter gave two NBC executives an idea. Brandon Tartikoff and Warren Littlefield turned to each other and said, "There might be something in this kind of relationship with older women," says Thomas. Paul and I and another writer went to a pitch meeting with them for another show, and they were not interested. But they told us about the two old ladies thing. The writer who was with us said, "I don't write old people." So Thomas and Witt brought in Harris, Witt's wife, who had previously worked with them on the sitcom Soap, to make TV history. "The original premise was two women," Thomas adds, "so we kind of went a little crazy." The actress who played the young version of Bea Arthur's Dorothy in Flashbacks believed Arthur disliked Betty White because she thought White was phony. Bea prided herself in her lack of artifice, in the fact that she was a straight shooter and she didn't suffer fools, and you couldn't bull-S her, says Lynn Green, 71, who appeared in 4 episodes. And I think there were times Bea saw more of Sue Ann Nivens, White's Mary Tyler Moore Show antagonist, than of Rose Nyland, in that I'm not sure she thought Betty was always sincere. Somebody being overly agreeable can sometimes contrast and make you look like you're an ogre. I don't think it was easy for Bea, who's so serious. That also made getting Arthur's stamp of approval all the more meaningful. Green remembers being terrified to make her first appearance in 1987. "But it got easier with every episode because I caught Bea looking at a playback of my scene in her dressing room and smiling. I could see she was pleased at the portrayal. That was everything." An Emmy-winning guest star got booed at the end of taping an episode in which she played an anti-Semitic author. "I didn't think that much of it," Bonnie Bartlett, 96, says of her first impression after reading the script for Dorothy's New Friend in season 3, in which she played bigoted Barbara Thorndike. "But then when we were shooting it, they had 3 different old gentlemen that came in to play Sophia's Jewish boyfriend, and 2 quit. That's when I realized that 2 old gentlemen gave up a day's work because they were offended by the scene. And then when I came out before the show, there was applause from the live studio audience. They knew me from Ellen Craig on St. Elsewhere. And when I came out after the show, they booed me. My husband, her St. Elsewhere and Boy Meets World co-star, William Daniels, said, "That's what you get for taking an anti-Semitic part." Nearly 4 decades later, she still gets recognized by fans as Barbara Thorndike. The man who directed the most episodes of the series initially turned down the gig. "I had been approached fairly early on about doing it, and I said no, not having seen it," recalls Terry Hughes, 85, whose pre-Golden Girls credits included episodes of the Sarah Jessica Parker sitcom Square Pegs. "I didn't really want to work with 4 old ladies on a show, and I very casually and stupidly said, 'No, I'm not interested.' When the 2 directors who'd done the 10 episodes after the pilot didn't work out, Bea Arthur suggested they go back to Hughes, who says, 'I went in and watched the pilot, and I realized how stupid I was just to reject it out of hand and realized how brilliant it was. He took the job and stayed from episode 12 in 1985 until 1990. It was an instant rapport with the ladies. By the end of that first week, I felt as if I'd been there forever. Estelle Getty didn't think her scene-stealing character was funny. Her experience had been in this Jewish theater in New York, and this must have been an overwhelming experience that she handled so well to find herself internationally famous in her 60s, Hugh says. But she had a down-to-earth skill. She didn't always know why what she was doing was funny, but it was, and she would sometimes question it. It must have been hard for her at the beginning to fit in with those ladies. By the end, she created an incredible character in Sophia. Getty, who died in 2008 at age 84, after suffering from dementia for years, struggled with memory issues while on the show. She would do 20 takes before she'd nail it, so that you were doing it over and over and over. By the time you got to 20, you weren't so great, but she would get it, Green says. And I think there was a lot of frustration with her until people realized this was a medical condition. Dorothy's ex-husband, Stanley Zbornak, played by Herb Edelman, was the Golden Girls' secret weapon. I had a fail-safe if ever a script was not up to scratch, or I thought we weren't getting the laugh. My go-to was always, let's get Stan in for a couple of episodes, because he was a surefire laugh riot, says Hughes. I loved that man, and we would sometimes, even if he wasn't in the script, at least on two occasions I remember bringing him in just to bolster a scene and give us some extra comedy, because he was so terrific, and the relationship between him and Bee was great, often overlooked. His contribution to the show was enormous. Thank you for being a guest star. Mario Lopez. In 1987, 2 years before Saved by the Bell, he played Dorothy's gifted student, which he calls a wonderful experience. George Clooney. ER was still 7 years away when he appeared as an undercover cop trying to catch a pair of jewel thieves in a 1987 episode. Quentin Tarantino. The Oscar-winning screenwriter and director scored an early acting role as an Elvis Presley impersonator in 1988. Burt Reynolds. In a 1986 episode, the Smokey and the Bandit star dropped by the house to take Sophia to lunch. Julio Iglesias. The Spanish crooner was Sophia's surprise Valentine's date in a 1989 episode. This has been Secrets of the Golden Girls from People Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. 5 Secrets to Aging Well from a panel of experts who are doing exactly that. By Cassie Hurwitz, published May 22, 2025, from Oprah Daily. Longevity is on everyone's minds. How do we live to 100 while feeling forever 31? All the conversations seem to verge into biohacking territory. But there are tricks to living longer and better that no full-body MRI or colostrum supplement can beat. To put the well back into the aging well conversation, Oprah Daily editorial director Pilar Guzman moderated a panel on Monday for the Hearst magazine's Women's Health Lab. She was joined by Deborah Roberts, co-anchor of ABC News 2020, Lo Bosworth, founder of Love Wellness, Stephanie Trentacoste McNally, MD, director of OBGYN services at the Katz Institute for Women's Health, and Tamsin Fidal, author of How to Menopause and host of The Tamsin Show. When we talk about longevity, we're not just talking about biohacking our way to triple digits, Guzman began. We're talking about our health span, about what it really means to live a long, fulfilling life physically, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. These things increasingly are entwined and inextricable from one another. Here are five takeaways from the conversation. Number one, don't be afraid of menopause. Fidal has been outspoken about her menopause journey, and she shared the moment she first realized something was happening. I was on the air doing the news. I'd been having problems with the teleprompter. I'd look at a word and go, well, I don't know that word. This particular night, I felt that hot flash heat come up from inside me and just spread everywhere. Sweat under my arms, my hair, my scalp, everywhere dripping. I had no idea what was going on. I thought, I'm going to pass out. My heart was racing. I left the anchor desk and went right down onto the bathroom floor to cool off my body. I never finished the newscast. I wound up going to the doctor. Three doctors later, I ended up with a note in my patient portal. Menopause. Any questions? And that was it. Fatal's experience compelled her to write her book so other women don't have to question that first hot flash. It's also why we cover perimenopause and menopause so extensively, from Oprah's candid conversations to the facts on HRT, Just Say Yes, to all kinds of helpful resources. Number two, oral health is in, wearables can wear you out. One of the most underrated forms of taking care of yourself is good oral hygiene, said Bosworth. There's more and more information coming out that connects the oral microbiome to cognitive function. You already knew this, but flossing really is your best friend, as is going for biannual dental checkups. And what about all those IV drips influencers are posting about? Overrated, Bosworth says. She also notes that wearables like glucose monitors and sleep trackers aren't really worth the hype either, because they might create unnecessary stress in your life. McNally agreed, saying that you need to outline a goal rather than simply track your body. It's telling you that you're not sleeping, and you knew that already. Bosworth adds, if you're not actually changing your lifestyle, the wearable isn't doing anything except making you feel bad about yourself. Number three, it's really worth it to prioritize sleep. I am sure everybody knows that when you sleep more, you feel better, Bosworth said. but people don't want to go to sleep for some reason. You want to play on your phone. You want to watch Real Housewives. You want to do all the other things except put yourself to bed. I have tried in the past couple of years to focus on that specifically, and I think that that has helped me dramatically. Number four, relationships are the real secret sauce. Sorry, introverts, but it's true. Guzman cited the Harvard study of adult development, which has been tracking the same group since 1938. The most powerful indicator of those who survived well was having good relationships and actually working and fighting for them, she said. Robert shared that she focuses on that in her own life. Surrounding ourselves with friends and people who are hopeful and optimistic and social, I think that has a lot to do with aging well. When Roberts first started at ABC, she worked under the legendary Barbara Walters and was terrified to tell Walters that she was pregnant. I was so shocked when she said, "Deborah, this is so great. Focus on your family. Because that's one regret. I should have paid more attention to my personal life." That gave me permission to think more about balance. Number five, aging well means not doing it all. As women, we want to attack all the things, Guzman told the audience. But each panelist said that it's okay to take a step back. I give myself permission to take care of myself and not wait for someday down the line after I get everything else taken care of, Fadel said. And that's something aging will teach you too. I don't worry as much about what other people are saying, Roberts added. I used to want to please a lot more, and now I'm willing to please myself more. Guzman wrapped it up aptly. As we hit certain milestones, we give fewer Fs. You've been listening to 5 Secrets to Aging Well from Oprah Daily. Princes William and Harry, Brothers at a Crossroad. 28 years after Princess Diana's death, William and Harry remained devoted to their mother, yet their fractured relationship shows no signs of healing. By Simon Perry from People. On July 16th, as the 28th anniversary of his mother, Princess Diana's death loomed, Prince Harry took a poignant walk through a minefield in Angola, retracing the brave steps Diana took nearly 3 decades ago to shine a light on the hidden horrors of war. Mere weeks earlier, on what would have been their mother's 64th birthday, July 1st, Prince William honored her legacy in Sheffield, England, celebrating the 2nd anniversary of Homewards, his bold mission to end homelessness, an issue Diana championed with steadfast dedication. What was once a shared mission to honor their mother now unfolds on separate paths, with no communication between them. We all remember the days when Harry and William were joshing with one another, and it all seemed set for their relationship and the future. That Harry, as Diana always used to say, would be William's wingman, says Diana's biographer Andrew Morton. It's a great loss for the monarchy. The brothers grew up sharing a royal life, an experience only they can understand, weathering their parents' scandalous divorce and enduring the unbearable pain of losing Diana after a car crash in Paris on August 31, 1997, when her sons were 15 and 12. But now they're worlds apart. While Harry, 40, has spoken openly about his hope for reconciliation with his family, insiders say his calls and messages to William, 43, have gone unanswered. That separation extends to the next generation. In Windsor, William and Princess Kate, 43, are raising Prince George, 12, Princess Charlotte, 10, and Prince Louis, 7. Across the Atlantic in Montecito, California, Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, 44, are raising Prince Archie, 6, and Princess Lilibet, 4. The cousins have not appeared publicly together since 2019, before Lilibet was born. The rift exploded into public view in 2020 when the Duke and Duchess of Sussex stepped back from their royal duties. Things were said that sparked the initial rift, and it's never healed, says Morton. In his memoir, Spare, Harry describes a tense 2019 confrontation where William criticized Meghan and, according to Harry, physically grabbed him by the collar, knocking him to the floor. The divide only deepened after the couple's explosive 2021 interview with Oprah Winfrey, followed by their Netflix docuseries and Harry's best-selling book. Each delivered sharp criticism of William, King Charles, 76, Kate, 43, Queen Camilla, 78, and the institution they serve. "Some members of my family will never forgive me," Harry admitted in May. Says Robert Lacey, author of Battle of Brothers, "The rift is very profound and very long-lasting. It will not be changed, in my opinion, until Harry makes a move and apologizes." Adds historian Amanda Foreman, "Everyone wants it to happen on their terms, but that's what makes it impossible." Despite the gulf between them, both brothers remain united in one shared vow: to honor their mother's memory. Long before the siblings' estrangement, Diana taught them what legacy looked like: a new kind of royal life rooted not in pomp, but in compassion. She didn't just infuse their lives with normalcy through visits to amusement parks and burger joints. She also took them to shelters for the unhoused. One was London's The Passage, whose CEO Mick Clark says, "William's visits with his mom left a deep and lasting impression." The prince, he adds, has spoken about how Diana made it very pointed that he was exposed to life beyond palace walls. That is something he and the princess are doing with their own children. That grounding in service has shaped William's public life. During the COVID pandemic, he made unannounced trips to shelters, helping prepare meals and even delivering food, always without cameras. "I think he feels more comfortable when it is just him," Clark says. For his part, Harry found his calling in supporting young people affected by the AIDS epidemic in Southern Africa. Between finishing school and beginning his decade-long military career, he visited Lesotho, where he was deeply moved by the challenges facing vulnerable youth. In 2006, he co-founded Centibale, meaning forget-me-not, Diana's favorite flower in the local language, with his friend Prince Seeso as a tribute to their late mothers. Over the next 19 years, the two poured blood, sweat, and tears and their own money into building this charity up to what it was, a multi-million pound charity that delivered nothing but good for the beneficiary community, a friend says. Devastatingly for the pair, they parted ways from the organization earlier this year following a dispute with Chair Dr. Sophie Chandauka over its management. Harry now plans to focus on new ways to continue supporting the children of Lesotho and Botswana. Tessie Ojo, CEO of the Diana Award, the only charity to bear their mother's name and one they now support separately, has witnessed the prince's dedication firsthand. I've seen how they watch young people who never met their mother articulate the impact she's had on them. There is a sense of immense pride. Wow, my mother did that? Still, many royal insiders and experts agree that the brothers' estrangement weakens the impact they could achieve as a unit. If they could do anything together, properly and genuinely, the force would be a tsunami. It would be incredible, says historian Amanda Foreman. Despite the emotional and physical distance between them, William and Harry have each created home lives grounded in a shared commitment to providing their children with a genuinely authentic upbringing. And that is pure Diana, says Foreman. Both brothers have also honored their mother by giving their daughters her name as a middle name. They often speak of her to the children, and her photograph is displayed throughout their homes. The values they are instilling and discussing as families may be best their best success, Foreman adds. They are both very good role models as parents. There are glimmers of hope that change could be on the horizon within the royal family. On July 9th, Harry's representatives met in London with the head of communications for his father, King Charles, a tentative first step toward mending the fractured father-son relationship. A face-to-face meeting could happen as soon as September, when Harry is expected back in the UK to support Well Child, a charity helping children with life-limiting conditions. Whether that reunion will materialize, however, is far from certain. William's team, notably, was not involved in these discussions. For the Prince of Wales, priorities lie elsewhere. Supporting his wife, who is recovering from cancer treatment, and guiding their young family through pivotal years, with attention to 12-year-old George, his heir. With his focus clear, sources say, William's anger has calcified into indifference. He's not letting it get to him at all anymore, a friend told the Sunday Times in June. It used to be that the family stuff took up a lot of space in his head. It was a very close relationship, and he was very upset. Royal biographer Sally Bedell Smith sees this as William accepting limits. He can control what he does in his life, but he has no control over what Harry does. Adds historian Robert Lacey, they both deeply believe that they're fighting for profound points of principle. Though silence now divides them, Diana's influence remains a strong bond that still shapes their every step. This is the sadness of it. They aren't supporting each other like they should be, says a source close to the royal household. That's what any mother would want, that they are there for each other. Adds Morton, whose latest book, Winston and the Windsors, is out in October. Diana always used to say she had two boys for a reason. The younger would be there to support the older in the lonely task as future king. There is no doubt Diana would have tried to act as a peacemaker between them. If she had been around, things would have worked out in a different way. Honoring Diana, together and apart. A Family's Heartbreak. On September 6, 1997, William, Harry, and their father Charles solemnly walked behind Diana's coffin at her funeral. They dealt with the shock and trauma in different ways, Morton says. African Mission. In 2006, Harry co-founded Sentebale to aid vulnerable youth in Lesotho and Botswana. Though he stepped down in March, he remains absolutely dedicated to supporting the children, a friend says. Royal engagement. William proposed to Kate in Kenya with Diana's iconic sapphire and diamond ring, a symbol of his mother's enduring presence. Joining forces. William, Kate, and Harry united in 2016 to launch the Heads Together mental health campaign. That open-armed approach to the world comes from their mother, says Lacey. A tribute in love. Harry's 2017 engagement ring for Meghan featured two side stones from Diana's personal collection, framing a cushion-cut diamond from Botswana. Walking her path. In 2019, Harry walked through a minefield cleared by Halo Trust in Angola, the first time he retraced Diana's steps. Carrying on her legacy is a responsibility I take incredibly seriously, he said in September 2024. Statue unveiled. The brothers reunited briefly at Kensington Palace in 2021 to unveil a statue of their mother. We remember her love, strength, and character, they said. Legacy of service. William served Christmas lunch in December 2024 at The Passage, the homelessness charity his mother introduced him to, volunteering alongside others. You've been listening to Princes William and Harry, Brothers at a Crossroads, from People Magazine. Word of the Week, Anxiety Spiral. Read this if your brain always jumps to the worst-case scenario. By Cassie Hurwitz, published August 11th, 2025, from Oprah Daily. Who among us hasn't hightailed it from symptom to self-diagnosis? One minute you're realizing you've had a headache three times this week. The next, you're asking ChatGPT if you have a brain tumor. And try as you might, you are stuck in this mental loop from anywhere for hours to days. No, it's not a panic attack, but rather an anxiety spiral, a surge of uncomfortable, seemingly inescapable thoughts. Anxiety spiral isn't an official diagnosis, but rather a common experience for the panicky overthinkers among us. In an anxiety spiral, we're triggered by something that happened or a worry we're anticipating, explains Courtney DeAngelis, a psychologist at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Irving Medical Center. If the current economic climate has you worried about job security, for example, a meeting invite from your boss might inspire panic. As our anxiety gets bigger, our minds start to race, DeAngelis says. That might be accompanied by physical symptoms like a pounding heart, nausea, sweating, or clammy hands, which of course can make you spiral even more. Thankfully, you can teach yourself to get off the panic express. Try picturing the negative thoughts as a train car moving on a track. Then think about them rerouting onto a different track that's calmer or happier. Or visualize the thoughts as leaves on a stream or boxes on a conveyor belt, DeAngelis says, and watch them drift past you and out of your brain. Create further distance by flipping through an album of feel-good photos. Curate this in advance if you're anxiety prone. The more attention you give your anxiety, the more powerful and long-lasting it becomes, DeAngelis says. If we're not feeding it by checking on it, it will eventually fade. Don't give in to the monster. This has been Word of the Week, Anxiety Spiral, from Oprah Daily. Thank you for joining us today for the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, and I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed our stories today and make plans to join us again next week for another interesting and entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream it as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona apps for Apple and Android phones. Have a wonderful day and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.